there's only one, you know, challenger to monetary policy and central banking and money itself, and that's Bitcoin. It's the greatest tool that has ever existed against authoritarian states. It's not enough to just say, okay, it's 21 million supply cap. You need to understand why. Otherwise, it's meaningless. If you could go back in time and ask why was fiat introduced, it was because of all these deficiencies. But the moment there was trust introduced in the system, it started being abused. But now all those deficiencies have been resolved. So you don't need fiat anymore.
Vijay Selvam, how you doing, man?
Great. Thank you for having me, Danny. I followed the show for years now, so really honored to be on speaking to you.
No, I'm really glad to have you on. It's one of the things that is probably getting harder, but something I really want to concentrate on is making sure that I have plenty of new guests in the space. This is obviously the first time you've been on. You sent me your book, Principles of Bitcoin. I was just telling you before, I'm most of the way through it. Yeah, I've not quite finished it, but it's brilliant. It's really, really good. It's one of my favorite Bitcoin books I've read in a long time. I get sent and buy a lot of Bitcoin books, and I just don't have the time to read them all. But this is one that, for whatever reason, just hooked me. I've really enjoyed it. So I'm, yeah, glad to have you on. And what I want to try and do here is kind of go back, not fully to basics. I think this will be a show that will be valuable to Bitcoiners, but I also want to make sure it's the kind of show that can be sent to people who might be curious about Bitcoin, want to find out more, and just let people know the real fundamentals of Bitcoin, that it's not all just treasury companies and penny stocks. So I'm excited to get into this.
Yeah, me too.
So let's start. I think we should probably start with your background, because you've got a very interesting background. You were at Harvard Law, Goldman Sachs. You were like a TradFi guy. So tell us about your background.
Sure. So yeah, so I'm an attorney in the US, also a solicitor in the UK, originally from India, but I've spent most of my life outside India. Yeah, so most of my career at Goldman Sachs, I was in New York and then Hong Kong, and also Singapore for many years before moving back to London now. I was a lawyer on Wall Street during the 2008 financial crisis. I worked on a couple of bailout packages for, you know, some of the big banks. So I was very much in the thick of that in the early parts of my career. So that was a huge influence upon my, you know, the way I think about the financial services industry, economics, macroeconomics generally. And I became a major gold bug on the back of that. And I was for many years, until I discovered Bitcoin, obviously. I've also worked sort of on regulatory matters, currently International General Counsel at Gemini. So in terms of Bitcoin, I mean, so going back, I'd say it was 2013 when I first came across Bitcoin. My reaction to it was all the things you would expect from someone with my background. So, you know, Ponzi scheme, used by criminals, no intrinsic value, governments will shut it down, all those reactions, right? And it fascinates me that today, 12 years later, people are saying exactly the same things. It really blows my mind, right? But those were my reactions back in 2013. And then it took it was many years of initially, you know, rejecting it and then reluctantly learning about it and then really starting to get it. And I think, yeah, that was kind of my journey. And along the way, it was, something that I really spent a lot of time thinking about was, why is it that people with my sort of background find it so hard to understand Bitcoin? And there are many reasons for that. One is just, I mean, people are just lazy and, you know, people are just reluctant to do the work and read about it and understand it. Another reason is just arrogance. A lot of people are just really like, yeah, you tell someone who's made tens of millions of dollars as a hedge fund manager or, you know, private equity fund manager that you've missed the biggest investment opportunity of your lifetime. They're not going to react very well to it. They're just going to be very defensive, right?
I think it's also even more than that, because like you're definitely right, but it's kind of like telling them everything that they've ever done, learned about, and then done in business might be a little bit wrong.
Yeah, you're questioning. I mean, so the natural knee-jerk reaction is to be defensive. And many people come at it from that perspective. But there's not much, you know, you or I can do about that. You've just got to let these people come around to it eventually, you know, like the meme, everyone buys Bitcoin at the price they deserve, right? So I think there's a lot of truth to that. So you just got to let them be. But I thought where I could, you know, people like us can add value is, I think in the third bucket where people are missing, you know, the principles, like the core, sort of why are we talking about this? What was the core invention and creating a mental model for Bitcoin? It's really hard because it's really hard to come up with an appropriate mental model for Bitcoin simply because there's never been anything like Bitcoin before, right? So it doesn't fit neatly into any of your molds. So it is so paradigm shifting. So my endeavor was really to ask those first principled questions. Why are we talking about this? What was that core fundamental innovation? As you say, let's put aside the Bitcoin treasury companies. Let's put aside, treasury, you know, sort of Bitcoin reserves and all these things and you know, crypto and Web3 and NFTs and all that. Let's ask that basic question, what was the core innovation here, and start from there. So that was really my kind of objective. I wanted to write the book that I wish I had access to back in 2013. That was kind of my objective, and yeah, that's how it came about.
So maybe we should start there, because I mean, that is where you open the book, is like, why are we talking about this? And as someone who's come from a very sort of traditional background, who initially just dismissed Bitcoin, like, what was it that changed your mind on it?
Yeah, so like I said, you know, I was a gold bug. And so I actually believe that everyone should be a little bit of a gold bug before they become Bitcoiners, because I think that's the natural path to take. Bitcoin is digital gold. I continue to believe, I've always believed that is the best mental model, that's the best analogy, is digital gold, right? It's not a better MasterCard, it's not a better Venmo, Visa, or anything like that. It is digital gold, right? Satoshi was trying to disrupt central banking, he was trying to disrupt money. So that's the right kind of path. So I think to be a gold bug, you need to understand monetary history, you need to understand monetary policy, and also a bit of political history and all the things that led to where we are, right? So it's a natural path, I think. It's also an easier pill to swallow for many of the, you know, TradFi people like myself. So to answer your question, I was already there, having experienced the 2008 financial crisis, having experienced the moral hazard and all the systemic manipulation that was taking place. I was witnessed it firsthand. I've been on calls with Hank Paulson, you know, the Federal Reserve and so on, back in 2007, 2008. And I saw it all. So I think I was already there. For me, the leap was really understanding digital scarcity, just understanding the technology side of things. And then everything came together. It was understanding why, you know, it's not enough to just say, okay, it's 21 million supply cap. You need to understand why, otherwise it's meaningless, right? And that takes hundreds, thousands of hours of reading, of thought, of introspection, right? Before you really get it, because it's not just code. It's this entire incentive structure, economic incentives that come together to make it possible, to make it happen. So yeah, that was the moment for me.
Do you wish you could access cash without selling your Bitcoin? Well, Ledin makes that possible. Ledin are the global leader in Bitcoin-backed lending, and since 2018, they've issued over $9 billion in loans with a perfect record of protecting client assets. With Ledin, you get full custody loans with no credit checks, no monthly repayments, just easy access to dollars without selling a single sat. As of July 1st, Ledin is Bitcoin only, meaning they exclusively offer Bitcoin-backed loans with all collateral held by Ledin directly or their funding partners. Your Bitcoin is never lent out to generate interest. I recently took out a loan with Ledin, and the whole process couldn't have been easier. It took me less than 15 minutes to go through the application, and in just a few hours I had the dollars in my account. It was super smooth. So if you need cash but you don't want to sell Bitcoin, head over to ledin.io/WBD and you'll get 0.25% off your first loan. That's ledin.io/WBD. Bitcoin is absolutely ripping, and in every bull market, there's always a new wave of investors, and with it, a flood of new companies, new products, and new promises. But if you've been around long enough, you've seen how this story ends for a lot of them. Some cut corners, take risks with your money, or just disappear. That's why when it comes to buying Bitcoin, the only exchange I recommend is River. They deeply care about doing things right for their clients and are built to last with security and transparency at their core. With River, you have peace of mind knowing all their Bitcoin is held in multi-sig cold storage, and it's the only Bitcoin-only exchange in the US with proof of reserves. There really is no better place to buy Bitcoin, so to open an account today, head over to river.com/WBD and earn up to $100 in Bitcoin when you buy. That's river.com/WBD. What if you could lower your tax bill and stack Bitcoin at the same time? Well, by mining Bitcoin with Blockware, you can. New tax guidelines from the Big Beautiful Bill allow American miners to write off 100% of the cost of their mining hardware in a single tax year. That's right, 100% write-off. If you have 100k in capital gains or income, you can purchase 100k of miners and offset it entirely. Blockware's mining as a service enables you to start mining Bitcoin right now without lifting a finger. Blockware handles everything from securing the miners to sourcing low-cost power to configuring the mining pool. They do it all. You get to stack Bitcoin at a discount every single day while also saving big come tax season. Get started today by going to mining.blockwaresolutions.com/WBD, and for every hosted miner purchased, you get 1 week of free hosting and electricity. Of course, none of this is tax advice. Speak with Blockware to learn more at mining.blockwaresolutions.com/WBD. So can we go really like back to basics for a minute here? Assume that I know nothing about Bitcoin, because this is the kind of show that I want to be able to send to people who are interested in Bitcoin but have no real understanding of it yet. And this is probably, from the sounds of it, something you maybe learned in 2007, 2008 during the financial crisis. Like, what is money?
Yeah, so
I know that's a hard question, by the way.
No, it's what's unfortunate is very few people ask the question. Uh-huh. Right. So if you and that's why it's because the entire concept has been corrupted. Very few people understand that the money that they use on a day-to-day basis, fiat currency, is a 50-year-old experiment. It's a 54-year-old experiment. People just assume that governments have controlled money through history, but no, it's actually only since 1971 that that's been the case, right? So to answer the question, what is money, you have to really, I think at this point, the best place to start is Austrian economics. So you look at the father of Austrian economics, who's Karl Menger. So Karl Menger said that money is not necessarily a creation of the state. Money is any commodity. Like it's the most saleable commodity. By saleable, it means it's the most marketable commodity. And there are two aspects to marketability. One is spatial marketability, and the other one is temporal marketability. Spatial marketability is something that can be moved and transacted across space. So portability, right? Divisibility, verifiability, scarcity, like all these things. Well, you know, it's kind of scarcity goes on both sides, but scarcity is actually more temporal marketability, but primarily you think about portability and divisibility and fungibility and so on, right? That's one aspect to, you know, what makes a good money. The other aspect is temporal saleability or marketability, which is ensuring that your money retains its purchasing power over time. So protecting the fruits of your labor over time, temporal saleability. So the key ingredient for that, or key requirement, is scarcity, right? If you have 10 units of a particular money and, you know, when your kids get it, you have 10 out of a million, you know, units, and when your kids get it, it's 10 out of a trillion units, you know, it's not very good, right? So scarcity is absolutely key there. And then durability as well, and history and all those types of things. So these are the factors that make a good money. But the key point for, you know, the newbies is money is not necessarily a creation of the state. And this is the core of the Bitcoin kind of philosophy or movement, is the separation of money and state. And this is the question that you need, like people need to ask themselves, you know, should money and the state be separated? And the best analogy there is the separation of church and state. Most people, many of your listeners, if they are newbies, although I don't know what proportion of your listeners are newbies, but a complete newbie may be shocked by that, right? Just the idea of separation of money and state sometimes is like, oh my God, that's a treasonous notion. How could you even suggest that, right? But many people probably felt the same way about the separation of church and state during the medieval era in Europe. I mean, for thousands of years, the church and state were inseparably intertwined. Governmental authority, the state's authority, and spiritual authority were intertwined, right, for thousands of years. You go back in time, Hammurabi in Mesopotamia claimed to derive his powers from the gods, right? The pharaohs of ancient Egypt were seen as divine beings with sanction from the gods, and these were instruments to control people, right? And then I think it was 1534 that Henry VIII, separated from the Roman church because he wanted to have
get divorced.
strengthening the union of church and state. And it was only in the, I think it was what, during the French Revolution and the US Constitution, really, that the church and state were formally separated. I mean, the word separation of church and state is actually, I think it might be Jefferson, talking about creating a wall of separation between church and state. And that's the First Amendment. So that was a huge pivotal moment in human history. It took strong men with vision to implement and execute that. The separation of money and state is arguably an even bigger, it would be an even bigger moment in human history because of the importance of money and, for humanity. Humans have never had the ability to do that until now. Right. So, So that kind of leads into Bitcoin, I guess.
So that you've said about eight things that I want to follow up on there. So let's go through it kind of one at a time. In a good way, by the way, this was great.
Yeah.
When you talk about the spatial and temporal like elements of money, gold is obviously very good at the temporal side of things, but not so good at the spatial side of things.
Yeah.
Can you just, for anyone that's listening, I just want to make sure that this is a very kind of easily accessible show, because I want this to be the kind of thing I can send to anyone. Like, why does gold fail at the spatial element there? And why does Bitcoin fix that?
So let me talk about this, the question about what is Bitcoin's core innovation, and that will lead into gold, because there's a perfect analogy. You know, it's interesting because there's thousands of pages and books that have been written about Bitcoin, and hundreds of thousands of hours of podcasts and materials that have been recorded. But all you have to do really is go back to Satoshi's original emails and you will find answers to virtually every question. Incredible, right? And so one of my favorite quote of Satoshi's is the one about the boring gray metal. He says, as a thought experiment, imagine there's a boring gray metal with nothing unique about it other than the ability. It's not, malleable, it's not shiny, it's not attractive, nothing unique about it, except for the fact that you can transfer it over a communication channel, right? So that's kind of essentially digital gold is what he was talking about there. So here's the thing, and I love Gigi, by the way. I don't know if you've, Gigi, I think he has been on the show when
a long maybe, time ago, yeah.
Never go. But he's been a huge inspiration for my book. I love some of his analogies. So this was for me a big aha moment, and light bulb moment. And that's why let me talk about it for a second. So what is Bitcoin's core innovation? It is the creation of a digital bearer asset. Now what does that mean? So when you talk about peer-to-peer transfers, a peer-to-peer transaction is where I give you something, you take it and you walk away. We don't need a third party to monitor that I, you know, don't give that same thing to somebody else. So if I took a gold bar and I handed it to you, Danny, you took it from me, you turned around and you walked away, you have absolute assurance that that gold bar, which you're holding in your hand, is with you. And there is no way that I can give that same gold bar to somebody else. Why is that? Because the laws of physics prevent that gold bar from existing in more than one place at the same time, unless you're some kind of magician, or I'm some kind of magician. Let's put that aside. But, you know, it's the laws of physics that prevent that from happening, right? That's the physical world. And that's why we can have throughout history, peer-to-peer transactions were possible. Now, if I sent you a photograph over email or WhatsApp, right, I could turn around and send that same photo to 1,000 other people, and they would have identical copies of that. Why? Because the photo is just informational. It is just zeros and ones. And information by nature is infinitely replicable at virtually no cost. And that, and so the only way to ensure that I don't send that same photo that I sent you to 1,000 other people is by having a trusted third party monitoring my WhatsApp or my email and confirming to you that, yes, Vijay has not sent that to anybody else, right? And that's how it has been for decades, like whatever, since, you know, we had online, you know, digital information and so on. What Satoshi solved was that he enabled you and I to transact digitally with you in Australia and me in London as if we were physically present. It's as if I gave you a gold bar and you took it and you took it from me and you turned around and walked away. You can do the same thing digitally, right? Now, that is a paradigm shifting invention. It has implications in the realms of economics, politics, you know, philosophy, and everything else, right? And that's really what it is. So I think your original question was around gold, right? So why did gold not work out, right? It's kind of in the end, I mean, it's scarce. It's worked as money for thousands of years. How did it get corrupted? It got corrupted ostensibly because of its deficiencies around portability and divisibility and verifiability, right? So, you know, if you and I needed to transact in gold, like 100, 500 years ago, I'd have to put, you know, slabs of gold in a ship and send it off and, you know, risk pirates, you know, robbing them along the way. I need to have security. It's not divisible, right? I can't transact in a small unit. It's not verifiable. There's fool pirate everywhere, right? It's not fungible. It's fungible, but it's not any of these other things, right? And that was what justified paper money. So people said, okay, put all your gold in a vault and let's issue some paper on the back of that. Paper is much more, easier to transport. It's more verifiable, assuming, you know, there's trust involved, but it's supposedly verifiable, right? And so those were the justifications for paper money. But the moment there was trust introduced in the system, it started being abused. Whenever there's trust, the only reason to build trust is so you can abuse it at some point, right? So that was the origins of that. And then, so if you take the entire history of monetary history, you can summarize it as, and some people would disagree with it, but I'm just gonna, you know, let's just for simplicity, barter to like grains and other things to precious metals to paper backed by precious metals to paper backed by nothing at all. That's the arc of monetary history, right? Now, what has Bitcoin done? It has solved portability. It's inconceivable to have greater portability. You can just literally remember 12 words and walk across a border with nothing but the shirt on your back. It has solved divisibility of quadrillions of sats and even more potentially if you need it. Perfectly verifiable, right? So in many ways, Bitcoin has made the original rationale for fiat redundant. So if you could go back in time and ask why was fiat introduced, it was because of all these deficiencies. But now all those deficiencies have been resolved. So you don't need fiat anymore.
So, I mean, that was very well said. But this is part of the reason why I've never got fully on board with the digital gold narrative. I know before you were saying you think that's one of the most powerful narratives in Bitcoin. But and I agree in a sense of trying to explain this thing that from the outside looks very complicated. But then when you compare it to the fiat system, it's actually very simple. But as a way of explaining it, I think it's great. And I think it's a very accessible way of explaining it. But I also, this is a terrible analogy, but it's almost like, to me, calling an aeroplane a flying horse. Like, because Bitcoin solves so many of the properties that gold couldn't, I feel like it's underselling it. And I feel like it maybe keeps Bitcoin in the store of value phase instead of foreseeing the future of it being a real medium exchange and a real unit of account. I don't know what you think about that.
So it's maybe because people don't fully understand the word digital, right? So within that word digital is all these other properties that you just described. If it's digital, it's basically like an email. So built within that word is the assumption that it's as portable as an email. It's as transactable as an email is, right? So maybe it's not fully, it's a single word that doesn't do justice to all those properties that you get via it being digital. I agree with you. Yeah.
Do you think we need to have better narratives in Bitcoin?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, in a perfect world, again, I think we would only be talking first principles. I think we would completely separate Bitcoin from crypto.
100%.
Right. Stable coins have come out of crypto. I'm not dissing anything about crypto, but let them do whatever they do. That's its own world.
It's a different world. Yeah.
It's a different world. So I would separate the two, but 99.9% of the world do not necessarily see that distinction. They see it all, it's all cut out of the same thing. Bitcoin and Dogecoin and so on are all, interchangeable, right? I literally 99.9% of the world, I think, sees it that way. So I think that is that in terms of narratives, I think clarification of that separation and what they are disrupting. This is just, there's only one, challenger to monetary policy and central banking and money itself, and that's Bitcoin. You need to understand that. I think that is the better narrative. And that's why I like digital gold, because I mean, particularly now in the last few months or the last few years, I think we are seeing this crazy move into, gold being potentially, we see some of the statistics, right? The dollar is now at 30-year lows in terms of its share of global reserves. It's just fallen to, 42%? It was 45, which was a 30-year low a couple of months ago. Now it's just fallen to 42%. Gold has risen to 25%. There's some tectonic shifts that are happening. You see all the BRIC nations that are, really loading up on gold. So I like that path. It's again, to simplify things, it's just easier. It's an easier pill to swallow than this magic internet money. It's like, it's just a nicer, it's an easier, yeah, path, really. Understand why gold, and then digital gold, right? I mean, gold, but it has all these deficiencies. So why not digital gold? And then you ask this question. So I just like that path better.
Yeah, I do think that makes sense. And like, I've never been a gold bug, mainly because I never had any money before Bitcoin. And Bitcoin was the first thing that I found that was like a real store of value. And like, the thing that I am very bullish on is it moving to these different, like the medium exchange and unit of account. And I just worry that digital gold keeps it kind of stuck in that same place. But let's move on to the separation of money and state, because I think this is actually really interesting at the moment, especially with everything that's happening in the US. Obviously, the Trump admin are kind of, I struggle to say adopting Bitcoin, but they're at least pretending to kind of be open to Bitcoin. And this isn't necessarily like the separation of money and state. It's more Bitcoin being integrated into the state. I don't know how you kind of look at all of that.
I caution against, it worries me that a lot of people adopt Bitcoin because they hear what the president of the United States or whatever is saying about it, because that can change on a dime.
100%.
In a panic sell because, oh, okay, like, you know, all the Democrats have come to power. They're going to reverse everything Trump did. And that's, you've not really understood the basic, the, you know, the fundamental reason why you're doing this. So it always concerns me. I'm very apprehensive of those types of narratives. But I did, there's a whole chapter in my book about, you know, Bitcoin as a reserve asset. And this was before the recent, when I wrote the book, you know, this wasn't really mainstream conversation. Trump hadn't been elected. But I spent some time thinking about it. So what struck me when I was studying, you know, I guess political history primarily was you know, the age of enlightenment in Europe was a key period in history. It was 17th and 18th century. That was a time when individual liberty started to take precedence over absolute monarchy. It was a key period. It was the first time when those kinds of ideologies came to the fore. And all these ideas of self-sovereignty and libertarian philosophies and so on, I wouldn't say that it was the, you know, they were born during that era, but they really came to the forefront during that period. The American forefathers were greatly influenced by those ideologies. And if you think about, I think, you know, Benjamin Franklin says, it is the first responsibility of every citizen to question authority. It's crazy to think about, you know, that kind of a statement, right? Thomas Jefferson says, it is the natural progression of things for liberty to yield and for governments to gain ground over time, or something. I'm maybe butchering it a bit, but something like that, right? And if you just think about it, the Constitution was largely to protect people from the state. Those are like incredibly powerful sort of, you know, ideologies. And you think about where we are today, where we've just subjugated ourselves to, you know, the state and unquestioningly, you know, accepted surveillance and you know, loss of privacy and corruption of our money, right? So when I was thinking about all that, I you know, this, I can go on about it, right? The separation of powers within the UK government, separation of powers in the UK as well as the US. You know, I think again Thomas Jefferson or Alexander Hamilton. I think Alexander Hamilton says you need to have ambition to counteract ambition. So like different arms of the state challenging one another in order to not allow one arm to become, you know, absolutely powerful. What are all these things? It's decentralization, right? It's decentralized consensus, decentralized power. I can't help but think, like, I mean, when I read these things about American history, I can't help, or even in English history, you know, history, political history, these guys would have loved Bitcoin, right? It is, Bitcoin is in many ways that it's like the digital embodiment of these like American values of, you know, self-sovereignty and so on. So it just made a lot of sense. And I really love that. And there's a chapter where I talk about that and I talk about why, I mean, it in the current environment where the dollar is waning in its power, rather than risking another challenging, you know, a hostile nation, to Western values is currency, you know, coming to the fore. Why not adopt Bitcoin, right? I mean, and it looks like gold actually might turn out to be the one that comes to the, you know, fore.
At least first.
Yeah, at least first. So then again, like, why not digital gold, right? So especially given it aligns so well with Western values and so on. So I think people need to, well, when you talk about Trump, everything, people, the, you know, the Bitcoin strategic reserve and all these things, people should, it's great that we're having these conversations, and the Overton window, it's amazing that, you know, I mean, you and I have been around during a period where it would have been inconceivable, it would have been laughed out of the room for saying these things, and now
not even that long ago.
Yeah, so I mean, it's great that we're having these conversations, but I think people need to. The important thing is that people need to be pushing this for the right reasons, right? And yeah, and that requires asking those basic questions.
This episode is brought to you by the massive legend Iron, the largest NASDAQ-listed Bitcoin miner using 100% renewable energy. Iron are not just powering the Bitcoin network, they're also providing cutting-edge computing resources for AI, all backed by renewable energy. We've been working with their founders, Dan and Will, for quite some time now and have been really impressed with their values, especially their commitment to local communities and sustainable computing power. So whether you're interested in mining Bitcoin or harnessing AI compute power, Iron is setting the standard. Visit iron.com to learn more, which is iren.com. If you already self-custody your Bitcoin, you know the deal with hardware wallets. Complex setups, clumsy interfaces, and a seed phrase that can be lost, stolen, or forgotten. Well, BitKey fixes that. BitKey is a multi-sig hardware wallet built by the team behind Square and Cash App. It packs a cryptographic recovery system and built-in inheritance feature into an intuitive, easy-to-use wallet with no seed phrase to sweat over. It's simple, secure self-custody without the stress. And Time named BitKey one of the best inventions of 2024. Get 20% off at bitkey.world when you use code WBD. That's bitkey.world and use code WBD. One of the things that keeps me up at night is the idea of a critical error with my Bitcoin cold storage. This is where AnchorWatch comes in. With AnchorWatch, your Bitcoin is insured with your own A-plus rated Lloyd's of London insurance policy, and all Bitcoin is held in their time-locked multi-sig vaults. So you have the peace of mind knowing your Bitcoin is fully insured while not giving up custody. So whether you're worried about inheritance planning, rent attacks, natural disasters, or just your own mistakes, you're fully protected by AnchorWatch. Rates for fully insured custody start as low as 0.55% and are available for individual and commercial customers located in the US. Speak to AnchorWatch today for a quote and for more details about your security options and coverage. Visit anchorwatch.com today. That is anchorwatch.com. Going back a little bit in the conversation, memes and narratives are very, very powerful. And the narrative that I got into Bitcoin for was Bitcoin as freedom money. And it's a narrative that I'm unwilling to change. Like, that is what Bitcoin is to me. It's freedom money. And when you look at what's happening at the moment with, you know, privacy developers going to jail, we have like basically the only way of realistically buying Bitcoin for the vast majority of people is through these sort of KYC exchange choke points. There's also like government started to stack Bitcoin or stolen Bitcoin. Like, are we truly separating money and state?
You know, there's so many attributes of, you know, there's permissionlessness, censorship resistance, unconfiscatability, and absolute scarcity, right? These are the four core properties of Bitcoin, right? And they're all very, very valuable. But I think I'm one of those people that would say that the one property that is a little bit, you know, like everyone's created equal, but some are more equal than others. There's one property more, you know, that little bit ahead of everyone else, and that is the absolute scarcity. Mm-hmm. Right? It's more important. It's a little bit more important than censorship resistance. It's a little more important than, you know, unconfiscatability, permissionless. It's a little bit more important because that is at the core of it. And as long as that cannot be corrupted, Bitcoin cannot be co-opted. Like, I don't care. I mean, Hal Finney was talking about Bitcoin banks, right? In the first few months of coming across whatever, for a couple of years or whatever, coming across Bitcoin. None of this is new. He didn't see that as he was cypherpunk, like as cypherpunk as it gets, right? And he didn't see a problem with that. The key piece that needs to be uncorruptible is the 21 million. And I don't think any of this co-opting and so on and so forth is a threat to that. Because people can always, I mean, look, if you're just going to put all your money in a Bitcoin treasury company or something, then, I mean, I'm sorry, that's on you, okay?
Yeah.
If you understand Bitcoin, you need to have a significant portion of it in cold storage because you have a little bit in these other leveraged products, right? To get more Bitcoin, but with a view to ultimately, hopefully, selling that and getting more Bitcoin, right? That is the kind of, you know, idea. So that's on you. And as things stand, nothing is stopping you from you know, selling your Bitcoin treasury companies or whatever and just buying cold storage Bitcoin, right? So I don't think there's any, at least I don't see a major risk to co-option or corruption of it. I think the greatest risk to Bitcoin is from within. I think throughout Bitcoin's history, like the fork wars, you know, the block size wars was probably the greatest threat that ever existed. I don't think any government banning it or co-opting and all of that was ever a risk to Bitcoin. But if there ever is a risk to Bitcoin, I think it comes from within.
So a bit earlier in the conversation, you were talking about the ramifications that Bitcoin has on both politics and philosophy. I know that you have a large part in the book about both of those things. Can we go through them one by one? Like, what are the ramifications this has on politics?
I think the biggest implication for politics is, it's the greatest tool that has ever existed against authoritarian states. And you take, you like, what is it? I think, Alex Gladstein, who was very kind to write the foreword for my book, he's written a lot about this and he has some great stats, but I think it's something like 75% of the world lives under some form of authoritarian regime, system, currently. And these are states where, it's like, you think about the financial banking system that works. It's kind of the backbone of our day-to-day existence, right? And when that system is weaponized against you, it's just not only that it doesn't work for you, and what is it, 1 in 3 people are unbanked, or 1 in 4 people of our fellow humans are unbanked. They don't even have bank accounts. And a much larger share of those people have that banking system weaponized against them, right? Parts of the Middle East or Africa and so on. For such people, Bitcoin is hope. It's the only thing they have to fight back. Alex Gladstein talked about this new law that was proposed. I'm not sure if it was passed, but this law that was proposed in Iran where any woman who's seen not wearing a hijab or just dressed in appropriate attire, it would be fined by an automatic deduction from their bank accounts. So there's no room for, paying a fine is one thing where you can either ignore it or challenge it or whatever, but waking up one morning and looking at your bank account and half of your money has disappeared because you apparently, was seen without your hijab. What recourse do these people have? And people, in the United States and in UK and so on, sit on their high horses in their, privileged worlds and poke fun at Bitcoin. What solution do they have for that woman in Iran? And now imagine a digital asset that is permissionless, censorship resistant, unconfiscatable, and absolutely scarce, where she can just store the fruits of her labor beyond the reach of anyone. So that's, I think that is the biggest political implication of Bitcoin. I talk about that. The other one, I think, in the political realm is, and this is what I think needs a lot more work, and it hasn't been explored sufficiently, is Bitcoin's impact on violence. and this is actually, Trace Mayer's written a lot about this, or he talked a lot about this back in the day. But if you think about throughout human history, the majority of violent acts have been committed in order to acquire or defend physical property, right? These wars for or to defend against physical property have shaped the maps of nations and the course of human civilization. The vast majority of human strife through history has been driven by the acquisition or defense of physical property, right? The resource curse is this thing where countries that are resource rich have been the ones that have faced the most conflict, right? I mean, colonialism, right? Western Europe, the UK went to India and parts of Europe. Why? Because of physical resources that they wanted to take, right?
Yeah.
Now, what happens when you move from physical wealth to dematerialized wealth, right? I think people have just not appreciated the power of that, right? You don't need vast armies and, fighter jets and tanks and naval forces to defend your physical property. And, you just need cryptography. So the cost of defense of your property is just plummeted, right? And you could use those resources for other purposes in your, you know, in your respective countries. So that is really huge and really underappreciated. So that I think to me that is the biggest political implication of dematerialized wealth, which is Bitcoin.
It's funny that you bring up Alex Gladstein, because I've just got into Bali this morning. There's a conference happening out here, and I'm really curious to hear what the conversation that they're having in a place like this will be. Because like, you go to a conference in the US and everything is just talking about like the financialization of Bitcoin in general. And Alex will be out here. He's bringing a whole squad from the Human Rights Foundation. And again, kind of back to narratives, I think that is one of the most powerful narratives. When Alex talks about the things that Human Rights Foundation are doing, and it, obviously it's not just Alex, he's amazing leader there, but like Arsh and CK and all the people working there, it's impossible to ignore. And when you look at like the background you've come from, going through like Harvard and Goldman Sachs, do you think that is one of the reasons that people from those kind of backgrounds find it so hard to understand Bitcoin, because they are coming from a very privileged position?
I mean, so this is why I actually asked Alex to write the foreword for my book, because I agree that is one of the most underappreciated, and just, I mean, people are most people would be shocked when you say Bitcoin and human rights in the same sentence. They probably just go like, what are you talking about? That, you know, how this is, you know, because this internet Ponzi scheme, like, what are you talking about? How does that have anything to do, you know, with human rights? And that's why I wanted him, and I'm very glad that he agreed to do it, because it is the most underappreciated aspect. It's the permissionlessness, the lifeline that it offers to unbanked people around the world. You know, what is it? 90% of South Sudan is unbanked. Can you believe that? I mean, that's a country where 90% is unbanked. You know, 200 million people plus in India are unbanked. 60 million people in Mexico or something like that are unbanked. And all these people have cell phones. You just connect to the internet, open a wallet, and you're banked. And that's huge. But people, it's massively underappreciated, because I can only blame the media for that, right? You have the media constantly talking misinformation. The only thing they say about is volatility. You know, Andrew Sorkin or CNN, just constantly obsessed with volatility. It's cannot see beyond volatility. It's just a complete obsession.
Yeah. And I've spoken about this before on the podcast, but again, with the Human Rights Foundation a couple of years ago now, I was out in Malawi, which by like many metrics is the poorest country in the world. And a few days before we got there, their currency was devalued by 40% overnight. And if you want to talk about volatility, that is volatility. Bitcoin is very stable comparatively. And like, this is the place where Bitcoin can truly be a lifeline. And don't get me wrong, I think this is coming to the rest of the world, but right now they're the places that need it most. The tricky thing is kind of the education and infrastructure to get Bitcoin to those people. But I mean, that's why it's important to have people like the Human Rights Foundation doing what they're doing.
Yeah. And the volatility argument, honestly, is something that has, you know, again, the obsession with it, it blows my mind, because there's such cognitive dissonance over it, right? Because if volatility is about, like, what is Bitcoin disrupting? Bitcoin is disrupting money, right? Of course, it's going to be volatile versus what it is disrupting. What were you expecting, right? I mean, You talk about, like, okay, so if volatility versus fiat, volatility versus the dollar is bad, by extension, then no volatility should be really good. That's a stable coin. What are you talking about? So if Bitcoin was successful in disrupting money, of course that the path to achieving that disruption was going. I mean, disruption is always volatile. The path to disruption is always volatile. It is not going to be linear, incremental. It's going to be volatile, because, you know, it takes time for Bitcoin to permeate through the psyche of humanity. People need to understand it. It takes time for people to understand it. And human understanding is volatile. Human, you know, emotions are volatile. So until a critical mass of humanity understands Bitcoin, of course it's going to be volatile, right? And I don't know why that surprises people. And on the other hand, volatility is falling, right? And this is the other thing. Like, if you just need to take the right time horizon, if you take a 4-year time horizon, look at a 4-year moving average of Bitcoin, the 200-week moving average, which Adam Back really loves to talk about, because that is a smooth up, 45-degree line that has never had a single down day. It is the most non-volatile sort of line. And if you're a young person, you should be taking at least a 4-year investment horizon on your investment. You should. Why are you looking at it on a minute by minute basis or an hourly? But you should be taking invest in it and come back 5 years later or 10 years later, for that matter, right? So it's really frustrating. But yeah.
I mean, that I do think that's interesting though, because like my time horizon when it comes to Bitcoin isn't 4 years; it's 20 years, 30 years. Like this is something I'm putting away for a long time. But on the positive side of that, I do think the time horizon that we're gonna have to push again as like a narrative in this is gonna reduce. Like it seems like volatility is reducing. I think that's a good thing for the adoption of Bitcoin. I think give it a few more years, and we could be talking about just put money away for 2 years, and then maybe it's 1 year, and then maybe like you just put money away, and like I think that's gonna be a massive positive. It's funny, like this conversation unintentionally has been kind of all about narratives. And one of the things you talk about in the book, and I know other people have written about this, is Bitcoin being like a mirror. Like whatever you want to see in Bitcoin, you kind of can. And I think that is one of the most interesting parts about it. Like if you're a very progressive person, Jason Meyer wrote books on this, like you can see your progressive ideals reflected back to you in Bitcoin. If you're very conservative, you can. If you're anarchist, you can. And I think while that is very important in Bitcoin, it's also one of the things that make it difficult to understand. And how do you look at Bitcoin in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, you see yourself in it in a way, but it also forces you to ask yourself who you are. It forces you to ask yourself where you fit on the continuum between left and right. Are you, or libertarian versus fascist? Where do you fit, right? Because those are ideologies. How important is privacy to you, right? How important is self-sovereignty to you? So it forces you to ask those questions. It also says a lot about who you are, in the sense that do you have the intellectual humility? Do you have the open-mindedness to admit that maybe you were wrong about it, right? Yeah. Maybe you haven't seen something, it takes a lot of intellectual humility and intellectual honesty as well. So it forces you to do that, and it reflects back, it kind of, if you reject it and you're not, it shows you who you are in that respect. And I mean, yeah, I close with that. That's my closing chapter in the book, because I think, it comes a full circle. It really kind of, you come back to yourself at the end of the day. And humans by nature they prefer the status quo, right? And that's because, it's risk aversion. And throughout history, and I have this list of, inventions and what people said about it. Historically, you have, of course, Paul Krugman talking about the internet being a fad in the 1990s. Every single major invention was completely trashed by people when it was introduced. Like even the bicycle, it's crazy, but the bicycle was completely, people said that, it leads to all kinds of health disorders. It's going to destroy, because women were riding bicycles around, it's going to lead to the degradation of morality in women and all these types of scaremongering, which has eerie parallels sort of with Bitcoin, right? It shows you all these things about yourself. Like, I mean, yeah, kind of, are you open-minded enough? Are you progressive enough to at least explore it, and then maybe adopt it and be an advocate for it, but at least, be open-minded enough to accept that, yeah, maybe you got it wrong. Maybe there's more to this than what you're hearing on CNBC or reading in the New York Times.
It's the freedom virus. When you talk about the ramifications on philosophy, this is one of the most interesting parts to me. I think we kind of touched on it a little bit there, but do you want to expand on that? I can add some context to that. Because like Bitcoin has definitely changed me as a person. And I know to people who may not be like deep into Bitcoin, that might sound like a wild statement, but things like time preference change your life in a huge way. And if you have money that you can actually put away and trust that it's going to retain value over time and like increase in fiat amount, like it does change the way that you view the world and the way that you interact with the world.
Yeah. So yeah, it comes back to the origins of consumerism, which is Keynesian economics. So fiat money depends on debt. It needs debt to keep going because you need to be able to spend, you know, future productivity today. Right? You need inflation. You need that all those things to work in order for it to be sustainable. So it encourages debt. It encourages overconsumption. And which in turn leads to environmental degradation and the destruction of civilization and culture along the way. So I talk about that, and I talk about, I mean, it's visible everywhere, like architecture. You know, it's sort of, you just look at the modern architecture, which is built to be, you know, made redundant in a few years when it's not fashionable anymore, as opposed to, you know, really a robust, beautiful architecture from a few hundred years ago.
I mean, I feel like you being in London, there's probably no clearer city to see that. You see like a beautiful 15th century churches and then just horrible glass buildings everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So these are all, you know, byproducts of fiat. They're all byproducts of consumerism. They're all byproducts of debt and just moral degradation in society. That's resulted from this system that we live in. So what Bitcoin offers is a way to go back to a bygone era of hard money. And if you think about it, I mean, that's why there wouldn't have been a way to do that. You know, that's why it's so powerful, Bitcoin, because it empowers individuals. It's this non-violent, without, you don't need a war, you don't need to have any kind of conflict, you don't need to have a revolution. It's a silent, peaceful revolution that all you need to do is transfer your value into this new unconfiscatable, permissionless, censorship-resistant, you know, asset that just exists in the ether. And that's all you need to do. You don't need to pick up you don't need to revolt against the state and pitchforks and all of that, right? So that's incredibly powerful.
I think it was really important to do a very sort of fundamental Bitcoin show. And I know we've only touched on all of these things kind of quite briefly and very sort of high level. You have an open invite to come back whenever you want, and we can maybe get into more depth on them.
Yeah, maybe the one thing I will maybe, you know, sort of mention is, and this was the basis for the book as well, aside from the first principles aspect of, you know, describing things and asking the basic questions, was also the holistic aspect. And that's what the cover is. It's, you know, technology, economics, politics, and philosophy as a Venn diagram, and then Bitcoin at the center. And this was, we talked briefly about it, but the blind man and the elephant parable.
So this is the first page of the book, and I loved this. Honestly, I opened the book, read that page, was like, right, this is what I'm going to read.
So just for your listeners, so this is it's an ancient Indian parable, actually. So you've got these blind men, and you have an elephant, and they're asked to touch different parts of the elephant, and then try to describe what an elephant is. They don't know what an elephant is. So one guy goes and touches the elephant's tail, and he says, oh, the elephant is like a rope. Another guy touches the elephant's leg and says, oh, the elephant is like a tree trunk. And then another guy touches the elephant's trunk and says, oh, the elephant is like a snake. Right. So I think I've always thought that's a good analogy for Bitcoin, because you've got, you know, CNBC, that's, for them, Bitcoin is only about volatility, the New York Times, Bitcoin is only about the environment, right? So you've got to look at things holistically to see the full elephant. Right.
Yeah.
It's like the blind men all of a sudden got their sight back and saw the holistic elephant. And I think that's Bitcoin. And that's the idea that, you know, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. humans are wired to see things holistically. So if you look at it in a silo, if you only look at it from its economic aspects, you're going to miss its implications for people living in authoritarian regimes, its political aspects. If you only look at that without understanding its technology, words like censorship resistance and permissionlessness and scarcity are going to be just words. You need to understand where they derive their meaning from. So that was my idea, and that's why I tried to cover all of them holistically, bring them all together, because that's the only way to really see Bitcoin for what it is.
And that's one of the reasons why I think the last chapter being about Bitcoin as a mirror is such a good callback to that very opening parable, because I think when it comes... I've basically stopped trying to orange pill people, like just random people in my life. I've spoken to everyone I care about. It's been nearly 10 years of this. And some people have got it. Some people have chosen to ignore it. And that's fine. But now if anyone comes to me and asks about Bitcoin, I always try and start with getting them to ask the questions they want to understand from me, rather than trying to explain something to them. Because I think when you try and explain Bitcoin, because it is this huge, like, behemoth of a thing that touches so many different elements, like you can end up just describing the rope, or you can end up just describing the tree trunk. Like it's very hard to give a full holistic picture, which is again why I think this book is great. I really appreciate it.
Thank you Danny.
But like I say, Vijay, anytime you want to come on, I'm more than happy to do it. We should do another one and get into a little more depth. We've kept this quite surface level, but it's an important show, I think. For me, like, I've been doing a lot of shows on treasury companies and macro stuff, and it's nice to get back to kind of fundamentals of Bitcoin. This is one that I'll share out with friends who are like trying to get interested in Bitcoin. But we should do one where we do more of a deep dive at some point.
Yeah, I'd love that. Perfect. Thank you for having me on.
I appreciate the time, Vijay. Where do you want to send anyone who doesn't know who you are, doesn't know where to find you?
So my Twitter handle is VijaySelvamXO. That's probably the best place to find me. Yeah.
And by Principles of Bitcoin. It's a really good book. But yeah, thank you, Vijay. I appreciate the time, man. And we shall speak again at some point. Next time I'm in England, we should do one in person.
Yeah, I'd love that.
All right. Thank you, mate.